The conference is now being recorded.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Jupiter Mines shareholder engagement session. Jupiter's Chief Executive Officer, Priyank Thapelay, will talk to the investor presentation released by Jupiter on the 19th of February 2019. At the end of the presentation, we will open up for questions. Go ahead, Priyank.
Thank you. Let's start off by welcoming all of you to our Jupiter Mines session. And I really want to thank all of you because when we delisted the company, we delisted it without your support. And at that time, we basically had a plan which was to build the mine below other people's radar screen and come and relaunch the company, whether it was an IPO or to a trade sale, when the right time was there. And with Paul's support, Melissa's support, and some of the board, which is not here, we were able to do that. So I think we are where we are largely because of your support. And I hope you would agree that that was the right decision because we paid very good money over the last 3 years. And I can say that if someone asks me what is the strategy of the company, my strategy is very simple. Make lots of money and put it into the shareholder's pocket. And then the shareholder is very smart. They can decide what they want to do with it. If they're hard-earned cash, they can enjoy it. As far as we are concerned, our focus for the foreseeable future is to be mined in the manganese market. So we put a short presentation together. I think this presentation is already on the website, so for some of the people it might be a little bit repetitive, but I just use this as a script to go through what exactly we are trying to achieve. So this market, I think, has not been very, very good for the stock, but I think it's largely to do with what has happened generally in the mining industry. In fact, if we look at companies in the $500 to $1 billion market cap on a total shareholder return basis, how your shares have done and how much money you've given as dividend or buyback into the shareholder's pocket, I was quite happy to see that in that category, Jupiter is probably the only one which I can say is breaking even. Most of the other companies are very much in the negative. But the great thing about our IPO was that it was very, very well accepted in the market. And I think the reason why it was very well accepted in the market was the simplicity of the story. It's one big hole in the ground. And that hole in the ground produces 3.5 million tons of manganese. The export market out of South Africa is roughly 16 to 16.5. And we are 20% of the market. So we are from 3 or 4 years ago when we delisted the company, which was no production, just like a feasibility study. From nowhere, we have come and taken like 20% of the market. And that is substantiated by the fact that some of the top-notch Aussie resource funds backed the IPO. I mean, in fact, we sold the IPO in like 3 or 4 days. I spent literally 3 or 4 days in Australia, a day in Hong Kong, and when the book was built, there was very significant demand, and some of the funds are there, but by and large, the Australian fund managers have really, really supported. The other point I would like to make is that a lot of people are focused on the share price, and rightly so, because that is one that is probably the most fairest way to assess your company's performance. But the reality is that we've got about 2 billion shares traded. I mean, on a good day, you only have like a couple of million shares traded. So while the share price is very important, I think it's very much a function of like if tomorrow someone wants to buy 50 million shares, I do not think they will get it at like. And so that was reflected by the fact that the book was built. Some fundamentals, they had to pay the 40% IPO price. So anything less than that, the people who have backed, have been with me from day one, are not going to sell, I think, in my judgment, and anything less than that. This may be the next slide. So, manganese is something which not too many people have heard of. And I have to confess that till I got involved with the project, I knew of manganese because I'm a metallurgist by training, but I did not know the intricacies. But when I started to look at manganese as a metallurgist, I had done iron making, steel making, so everything started to make sense. So manganese basically goes into steel making. It provides the flexibility and the hardness. In fact, there's a very strong theory that when the Titanic struck the iceberg, it sank because the rivets did not have any manganese. If they had manganese, the rivets could have basically survived the blow because it was hard, it would have been flexible, and maybe we wouldn't have got an Oscar-winning movie out of it. But that's the way the manganese industry works, that you cannot substitute it. It's like if you want like a nice meal, you have to add the spice. Without the spice, probably you don't get a nice meal. So that is the way the manganese industry works. You only need 10 or 15 kilos per ton of steel, but you cannot make steel without it. It provides the hardness, it provides the flexibility. It cannot be substituted. In a lot of commodities, nickel can be substituted by something else. Manganese cannot be substituted. And when you recycle the electric arc furnace steel and all, again, you have to add the manganese to it. So manganese cannot be easily recycled. And it's literally a function of the steel market growth. I mean, over the last year or two, the Chinese steel market and the global steel market increased quite a bit. But the reality is that even if the steel market on a global scale increases by 0.5 to 1% of annual growth, then you will need one chippy mine every few years. And it's not going to happen, because the only place which has got the steel, the manganese reserve or the resource is South Africa. That's where God put the resource. But all the resource is 1,000 kilometers inland from the rail and the port. So the only way you can have like another chippy in 2 years' time, another chippy in like 5 years' time, is that you have to have a dedicated rail and port line, and that's just not there. As I said, 16.5 million tons is what the 2018 export will be from South Africa. When we started to build the mine, that export level was something like 10 or 11 million tons. So the South African Transnet Rail and Port, which is the para status, has done a phenomenal job. I mean, without their cooperation, the manganese industry would not be what it is right now, at least in South Africa. But can they provide another 4 million, 5 million tons of rail and port capacity? No. So the only way you can get more stuff out of South Africa is using the trucks. Now, the trucks are more expensive, so that's a big issue. It adds to the cost of production. But the more important thing is that the amount of trucks needed for the manganese industry is finite. And if you look at the highway, if someone has been to where the Northern Kalahari is, and the highway which these trucks used to go all the way to either Port Elizabeth or Durban or Cape Town, that cannot take anything more. So it's a very, very good industry to be in. It's a very boring industry. It's below most people's radar screen. But the barrier to entry, because 80% of the world resources in South Africa, is literally the rail and the port, which in my judgment cannot materially go from what it is right now substantially. So, where's the next slide? And then there's a lot of talk. I don't think this is going to happen anytime soon. There's a lot of work being done that manganese is being talked about replacing cobalt in electric vehicles. So the first fact which I highlighted to you was that one or two chippy mines is needed, even if the steel market grows like at a very modest pace. So all this, if it happens, ever it happens, is basically the icing on the cake. But whatever research has been done, manganese, because it is cheaper, at least in South Africa, the mining is much more ethical compared to the DRC. That's the perception, and rightly so. And the fact that it is cheaper, much more readily available, and the amount of energy you can pack in a pound of manganese compared to a pound of cobalt is much more. So that's why manganese is being used or being considered as one of the cathodes in the electric vehicle batteries. And a German company which is leading this is BASF, and they have basically outlined some very strong progress in that field. So what is happening? I think if you look at our prospectus, which I know I only probably read once, but it's something which is very interesting for anyone who wants to know about the manganese industry. But the point which I'm trying to make is that 12 months ago, literally at the same time we were doing the roadshow, we had kind of promoted these theories. And what I can say is that while we might have been the first ones to say this thing, if you now look at any publication, whether it's CRU, IMNI, or any of the other manganese players, they more or less subscribe to this. So the first one is that about 30 to 40 million tons basically was being produced in China, but it was very, very low grade, like 40, 15. I mean, for us, anything less than 30% goes into the waste dump. So what they were mining was very, very low grade, which had a couple of issues. The first issue was that it was very costly. The second issue was that all these mines had very low life compared to, well, nothing is of the league of chicken, but in the single digits. But most importantly, this ore goes into ferroalloy smelters where you have to put like energy, coal and all, and the lower grade you put, the higher is the pollution. So what has happened is the same thing you're seeing in iron ore and in coal also in China is that a lot of the domestic production is going to go away. And in fact, over the last 2 to 3 years, if you look at most of the exports, about 30 to 35% of that production has gone. And the only place which can supply that has to be South Africa, but as I just now discussed, you cannot export anything more than what is being done, materially more than that, because the barrier to entry is the rail and the port. So it's a very good, from a supply-demand perspective, a good industry to be in. As I said, some of the major mines, I think there's a slide, if you look at the 4 or 5 other big mines, which are in the same league as Chippy, some of them don't have the sort of life which Chippy has, so they will go away. That potentially can take out 8 to 10 million tons out of a 30 million ton market. So again, when 25, 30 million tons might not happen like in the next year, 2 years, but it might happen in the next 10 years. And while it might not be very important for us, for the big steel companies, for the big ferroalloy players, they plan like 10 to 20 years in advance. So that change is going to happen. And as I said, like South Africa's manganese supply is constrained by the logistics port and the rail authorities. So it's a great industry to be in. I think we just now discussed that these are the two or three things which are playing up in China. So the demand and elsewhere in the global steel industry. So from a supply perspective, there's a lot of discipline or there's a lot of barrier to entry and a lot of the supply is going away. From the demand, even if like it trickles at a very modest rate, you have to have like more manganese, which cannot be coming out of South Africa, which has implication on the long-term manganese price. So will the price go back to like the $1.35, which I've seen for a few months? I hope not. But even at that price, we never lost any money on the cash basis. So the industry is changing quite a bit. Now, where that manganese price settles, who knows? The only thing I know is that for the last 3 or 4 years, every analyst, every expert, even our marketing guys, they've all got it wrong. So the only message I have for them is like, push 3 million tons as cheaply as possible, whatever is the price, just take it. If we just do that thing very simply, we'll make a lot of money. Half of that will come to the Jupiter shareholders, and then it goes into the shareholders' pocket. That's basically the business plan. So that's largely, I think, what I have just now sketched. For the first time in my life, at least in the last 3 or 4 years, I'm seeing the sort of forecast which the experts have put out in their various reports, close to what our feasibility studies have been. So everything which we look at, we use like a $4 to $4 price, so 50 price, and on that basis, if we can make a substantial return, we go ahead and press the button. And that's basically what we did. This chart only starts from 2016, but we started the project when I think the rand to the dollar was something like 10 to 1, now the rand is like almost 14 to 1 to the US dollar. We assumed a price of $4 to $4.50. The cost of the project was 2 billion rand, so the Jupiter share was a billion rand, which is roughly 100 million Australian dollars. And the cost of production for the feasibility was somewhere around close to 270 to 290 range. And fast forward 3 or 4 years from there, the rand is in our favor, so the cost of production is much more lower, plus the volumes which we are putting out are 3 to 3.5 million tons, whereas the feasibility study forecast a volume of around 2.4 million tons on a good production basis. So whichever way you want to slice and dice against the feasibility study, against the cost of production, against the life of mine, the project really, really stacks up. So again, it's a given, safety, we're very proud of it. We've been operating for 4 or 5 years until I think the September announcement which Melissa put out. I would proudly stand up and say we've never had like a stoppage, but that was the first time we had a stoppage, but within the weekend we sorted it, so it had no implication on our production targets and production plans. So the safety is a given. We own half the project, the other half is owned by our BE partner with whom we've got an excellent relationship, very amicable. This potential announcement which we put out that we are looking at expansion scenarios is a Chippy announcement, so both sets of shareholders are very happy to look at it. And as I said, along with our half ownership, we've got half the product to market. which we have been selling for the last 4 or 5 years, and not a single ship has been returned. So when we started the mine, we were happy to take a discount because we were kind of the new kid on the block. But now everyone knows what is the Chippy brand, and they all want a piece of it. So we sell about 75-80% of the product to China, we sell it to the Saudis, we sell bits to India. So everywhere where you can see like a substantial steel industry or a ferro industry, we are selling to. And again, I think I've already covered this thing. This literally shows like how well placed the Chippy mine is. What is not shown on this is on top of each bar, what is the life of mine, but I can tell you that this is the only one which has got like a three-figure life. There's no one else out there. So most of us in this room might be probably gone, but the mine will still be there. That's the beauty of this operation. And as I said, our cost of production last financial year was in the 220 range, against a feasibility study forecast of 270 to 290, and some of the other people who are operating in that part of the Kalahari, their cost is 35-40 cents per DMTU more than us. And yes, this is it. I asked them to put it in red, like this is a 100-year life. So a lot of people say that, what is your reserve, what is your resource, what is your exploration plan? I said, we've got enough, we don't have to worry about that. You can waste a lot of money trying to take things from like a reserve to a reserve category and all, but we do it like as and when needed. I mean, whatever we save here goes into our pockets. I mean, I'm one of the shareholders too. And I think the reason why this thing has been a great success, I think the Aussies know better than anyone else that bulk commodities is all about infrastructure. So once you can get the rail in the port, and once you have a very efficient load out station and a rail loop, that's half the battle won. 55% of our cost of production is basically this life. It's the rail and the port. So we have universally acknowledged, anyone you speak to will say that we have the best load out station in the Kalahari. We have this 8-kilometer rail loop which can basically load two rails at the same time, two trains at the same time. And from nowhere, I mean, we took a very entrepreneurial approach. We started the mine without having any Transnet rail and port allegation. The only thing which we had, or which we told Transnet, was that I think October 2012 we'll be ready to put like the first tunnel on the train. And Transnet said that if you'll be ready, we'll provide you the train. So just with that kind of like a handshake agreement, one can say we built this mine, and now we've got a 5-year contract like most other people, 2 to 2.1. The reality is that every time we can move from the truck to the rail is cheaper. And that has largely been the reason why we have been able to cut our costs. It's not that the rand has gone from 10 to 14. That's not the play. The play is also that we have a certain allocation from Transnet. And if you again look at the history of the Chippy mine performance, every year we have been able to get more rail than what our legal obligation is. So I believe this financial year only, on the 21st, I think at 10 o'clock, I got the email from our CEO saying that he has shipped on that day 3.511236 million tons. So we said to the market we'll probably do 3.5 million tons, and slightly more than that he has achieved. And out of that, although we should have sold roughly 2 million tons on the rail, I think he has sold about 2.5 million tons of that on the rail. So the team is incentivized. They come up with very creative ways how we can move like the trucks to the rail. That basically leads to a low cost of production. We as shareholders get much more profit, much more dividend. And their incentive is purely how much more than the business plan you can pump and how low compared to the business plan costs you can deliver. If you deliver that, they make like very, very good bonuses. So it keeps all of us very much aligned. So again, I think I've spoken about it, like out of nowhere, we are now the biggest single mine in South Africa. 16.5 is what will be shipped in 2018, 3.5 will come from us. So roughly 20% of the product is coming from South Africa. But as you can see, like South Africa is the dominant player. That is where the tons are coming from. But these tons cannot double or triple because the big, big barrier is the logistics. So I think at the end of the day, every CEO says they've got the best asset on planet Earth. They make all sorts of promises, but every 6 months, your performance is assessed. Every year, it's assessed. I can say that in our case, you can assess over the last 3 years. It cost us $100 million to build the mine. We have returned $300 million over the last 3 years to the shareholders. And we have a 100-year life. I'm sure the manganese price will go to 6, will come to 4. I don't know what the market will do. I mean, that's not my expertise. But what I can say is that whatever the price, the way this asset is set up, I'm fairly confident it will always make money. And as long as it is making money, we have no use of that money for the time being. And if there's no use for the company's cash coming out of Chibi for Jupiter, then the only bit is going to go in the shareholder's pocket. But you can see, I think, everybody asks, like, what is your view on the manganese price? I have no view. I mean, my only view is, like, pump the production as low a cost as possible. And these are the prices which we have been able to achieve over the last two financial years. And this is the kind of dividend which we have paid out or buybacks we have done. So that should give you some sort of an idea that what is the leverage of the manganese price to how much money the company can make. Every dollar per DMTU change in the manganese price translates to roughly ₹1 billion extra cash in the shareholder's pocket. Now, there's a lot of confusion. Half of that belongs to us, so the other half goes to the VE partners. So every dollar, $50 million extra to the company. But as you can see, I mean, it's pretty stable performance. What I call the bread and butter business is 3 million tons. So we will deliver 3 million tons of what I call 36.5% GP grade. And if we have like low-grade stockpile, and if we have like probably not the rail, but the trucks available, and the market is there to absorb it, we move it, and we try to move it, and whatever extra cash comes, we pay to the shareholders. And that's largely the reason why in the first half we paid ₹2 billion dividend, in the second half we had pretty much milked the cow, so there was nothing left, so we only paid out ₹1 billion. So what is this company all about? It's a very simple company. It's a play on steam, long life, low cost, large scale, no debt in the company. I mean, I would say I hate debt, but I'm not a big fan of using debt to build the projects and all, because you always have hiccups, and the last thing you want is to work for the bank. So, and now there's no point to put any debt in the company. But the third point is very important, that it's a strong cash generation throughout the cycle. And the primary policy is to pay out as close to $100 million. So if Melissa gets $100 from South Africa, she needs to keep like $2 or $3 to run her office, and then $96, $97 gets paid out to the shareholders. And the strategy is very, very simple. As we said, the way I've described to you, I think the supply dynamics and the demand and all, one thing should be clear is that it's a very tight space right now, and with some of the big mines going to phase out, there might be an opportunity to make GB bigger. I mean, if you double it, theoretically, we have a 50-year life. It still looks very nice on a presentation. So we are looking at an option. It all has to tie up with how does it impact the market, how the logistics and all work out. So all that is working. I mean, it's not something that should happen immediately, but we want to be ready that if the opportunity comes, we should be able to do something. And then, obviously, we are half the project. We would love to own more of it, so it's a commercial thing. As and when the alignment happens, and that is possible. And then the regional consolidation, there are a lot of players in the Kalahari, and there might be opportunity to consolidate, and if we can consolidate, we can make the company bigger. Probably we can, I would say like, cut the cost a lot, but probably we can run it more efficiently, and that will probably reflect in the cost. So this is where we are. I think everyone knows it's a very cheap stock. If you hold the stock and you don't look at the screen every day, in 4 or 5 years' time, all your money is basically paid back, and then you hold like a free option or a free share. And at least that's the way I look at it. I don't look at this thing on a day-to-day basis. But as I said, very low liquidity, very low volumes are traded, and I think if substantial volumes move from a buyer's perspective, then the price will be very, very different. But this is what our team believes is where we are trading and what the general market is, and there's a lot of opportunity to improve. And I think being a listed company only a year old, we made a lot of promises prior to the IPO. I'm sure with all the intent and all the good wishes, we got the IPO done, but people probably had an element of doubt that can someone really deliver like a 15%, 20% increase? I mean, this sounds too good to be true. But now we've shown for 3 years, so I think maybe we do that for another year, another 2 years. And we just need to be patient. And I think it will all reflect in that. So that's what I really wanted to come and speak to you about. Firstly, thank you for your support. very patiently supporting us when we were kind of like lying low and building the project. So this is what we have achieved. This is your company, and nothing is going to change. The only thing which will be my focus is these three things. That is my growth. If I can't do that, then you still get like a very handsome dividend, and every shareholder should be happy with it, and they can do as they deem fit. So that's it. I'm happy to take any questions if anyone has any.
Thank you, Priyank. So guests are now asked to
invite.
Now we've got audience here, so we are going to first ask the audience and then we'll go to the.
Sure, okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Priyank, the manganese cross that you put onto your website every Monday, is that genuinely reflective of the price that should be guessed? For give or take?
That's a good question. I think a lot of people wake up every day to look at the share price. I only wake up every Monday to look at that metal bulletin price, because for me that is the most important thing. But that's a very good question, because and it's not a very scientific thing. I think what metal bulletin does is like they call like 5 or 6 big sellers and 5 or 6 big buyers, and they take some sort of an average and they put it. But what we really do is like we have got 2 or 3 entities which are selling it. So every time I have the board meeting, I ask them to put a chart which shows like where's the metal bulletin, what is the price we have achieved. And you're absolutely right. There are some months where we might be a little bit low, some months where we are a little bit high. So that metal bulletin price is on a very high level, roughly reflective of what we achieve. The only adjustment you have to do is that. That is for a 37% grade, so you have to adjust it for the 0.5% grade loss. But yeah, close to it. Yes, please.
Sorry,
Anna. Oh, sorry.
Thank you. You talked about getting your stock onto rail, which you obviously take to HMPE or Durban, or perhaps Saldana Bay.
Saldana,
But when it gets there, are the ships always available to take it?
No, that's again a very good question, because the way it works is that, and I think I said it in some of the meetings, that Jupiter is a really funny company, because we generally go into the market 4 to 6 weeks before the product is to be sold, which has two implications that I think one of the things which must be evident is that Melissa has made the announcement that she can pay the dividend, but she's sitting on the money for 2 or 3 months. But that's the law of the land, that you have to declare your financial results, only then you can pay out. But we basically have sold the product so much in advance that she's already sitting with the money in Aussie dollars, and it's like getting whatever 2-3% as fixed deposit rate. The point where I'm basically leading to is that you generally get 4 to 6 weeks visibility from Transnet. So Transnet gives you the slot, which allows us to go into the market, and depending on the marketing guy's expertise, they can either sell now for 2 months later or 4 weeks later, or they can probably sell closer to day. So yes, the answer is that we get the slot, and on the basis of that slot, based on which port it is going to, what is the tonnage, we have the stockpile, we kind of like hire the ship, and the ship comes very close to when it has to be loaded, and then it goes to, as I said, 75%, 80% to China. So, but nothing works like a spreadsheet model, so there are some cases where the ship gets delayed or your train gets delayed, there is like some sort of some carriage gets overturned or something. So then the ship has to stand in the harbor for a while, and you have to pay like demurrage and all this and so forth. But in 4 or 5 years of operations, they have kind of perfected the art.
Just looking at that growth strategy focused on there, number 3 is interesting, regional consolidation, that may be buying more other mines. But what about 2? What are the possibilities of increasing your underlying stake in this city?
Yeah, I think
there's only 2 other shareholders.
Yeah, there are 2 other shareholders, but the 2 of them are through a pyramid structure. So I'm basically going to talk about the box, which is equivalent to the Jupiter box. The reality is, as I said in my presentation, is that we have a very good relationship with our BE partner. They are a BE partner, but they are, the way I look at it, pure commercial partner. We put our share of the capex, they put their share of the capex. We get our dollar profit, they get the dollar profit. We get our ton of sales, they get the ton of sales. So it's like a very, very cordial and amicable relationship. I mean, if you are ever a fly on the wall in one of our Chippy board meetings, you'll be amazed at how great this relationship is, because in most cases, the BE relationships are not as good or rosy as I'm sketching it out to be. So we have always been aligned. The only place where we have a slight misalignment is that we have been able to monetize the asset, list it, and the shareholders are happy holding the shares, or they can do whatever they want to do with the shares. But the B partner can't do it. So they are trying to explore their options of doing something similar on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. Now, they probably will go through the process. We will know where they come out. And depending on that, there might be some sort of an opportunity to do it. So that is one thing we have to look at. The other thing is, like, we also have to see, like, how the new mining charter shapes out, because that will dictate what is the threshold which the BE partners have to maintain, whether the once-in-part, always-in-part situation. If that happens, then theoretically, Jupiter will go from 49.9 to 100%. So all those things, I think, will shape up over the next 6 to 9 months. There's elections now in South Africa on the 8th of May. So once everything has fallen in the right place, then the board of Jupiter will sit and see, like, what is the right thing for us to do. But right now, we own half the product. We sell. We have half the project. We get the half profit. It's not that
just
bad.
Just one other comment.
Sure.
Not a question, but a statement, I guess.
Yeah.
I was interested in one of your earlier presentations, slide 25,
yeah,
where you're talking about the sustaining capital required for the mine, which I think is very important, and I think you should include it in your next presentation.
Sure. Yeah.
But it points out that for the next 13 years, the sustaining capital investment for the mine is a total of $28 million
Australian
dollars.
Yeah.
Which is extraordinary.
No, and I think...
Sorry, let me just make one other point for the other investors here. If you're a mining operation, which we're all invested in mining in the Mesca, but if you're in gold mining, for example, the sustaining capital required is probably 90% of your profits. It has to go back looking for new ounces or new reserves. You don't have to spend any money on sustaining capital to maintain.
I think the reason for that is that we have a very homogeneous ore body, so there's no exploration. We've got 400 million ton of resource. We've got about 90 million ton in reserve, so we've got at least 25, 30 years locked in. When we come closer to that, we might have to spend a little bit more on the exploration. But the good thing is that, again, I don't want to trivialize it by saying time and again, like, one big hole in the ground, but 35 million tons is being moved, 3.5 for the ore and about 10-to-1 strip ratio, so a lot of it is waste. So, but once you've done that, it's like cutting slices of butter. So it's like very, very efficient that way. And everything is done on a contract mining basis. So whatever has to happen on the mining side in terms of the capex and all, that is all reflected in our opex. The only big capex which we are going to do is that when we pay, or when we are going to pay out this R1 billion and we get a half share, we have kept aside 150 million rand, so roughly $15 million. For two projects. One is to explore the option of connecting to the grid, because when we were starting, the situation was quite bad. It's still bad, but not as bad as before. So we built our own power station, which is more expensive than connecting to the grid. So that is one thing which we have provided for. And the other is that we need to connect one of our secondary crushers to the loadout station, because right now it's multiple handling, and when you handle more and more, the cost goes up and you create more fines, and the fines rate at a discount to the premium product. So all those two things have been provided for. Once you take out that, then the sort of things you have to provide for is like some new truck, or they want like something like a cafeteria or like a meeting center for the union workforce, so you do that. And then some of the other things, like for us, one is the production, the other is like what is the grade we are producing. So no one thought that we'd produce 3.5 million tons, so the sort of lavish they have was only for 2-2.5 million tons. Now, we want to make sure that we keep on producing 3 and above, so you probably have to build another lab, new XRF equipment and all. So those are the sort of things which fall in that category, but you're absolutely right. The cost which you see is basically OPEX, CAPEX, whatever you want to put in it, and beyond that, as I said, it's like de minimis. And the only thing which we have to pay is, when you take the money out, is a 5% withholding tax, and then everything comes here, and then when a sir pays, what do you call? Unfranked dividends are lost. Yeah, that's the way it works.
There was some chatter, I think, in the press about you maybe talking to your neighbour, South 32. Is that still?
Well, as I think we have said in the prospectus and maybe in one of the announcements, I don't remember, is that there is a barrier pillar. So, long time ago when Brian was involved with Samancor and Billiton, this used to be all part of like one entity. And then in 94 when the apartheid ended and when Mr. Mandela came to power, the use it or lose it and the BE legislation came about. So, I don't know what to say, but maybe the previous owners got the wrong call and they decided to part with this asset. So this asset basically came to our BE partner, and because of Brian Gold connection and our mining expertise, they came to us. So that is the history how we got involved. But as part of like running two separate entities, you have to leave an 18 meter boundary, so 9 meters each on both sides. Now what I think you are referring to is that both us and South 32 have agreed to take it out. So once that is taken out, which will be over the next 18 months, then the ore which we will be able to access, at least for a year, will be at a very low strip ratio compared to the 10:1 which we spoke about. So that is the economic rationale for us to go after it, that if you can mine something which is like cheaper, let's do that sooner rather than later. So both sides have agreed, the DMR has approved, because they have to drink the holy water to make sure like everything will be done properly. So once all that happens, then we go into taking out the ore burden. And then after that, we mine our ore, and they mine their ore. But the great thing is that we are going to take out the ore burden because our cost is cheaper.
You also have this, the difference in costs between road and rail.
Yeah, the difference, again, that's a very good question, because when we had the IPO, I think the IPO document talks about it. It really changes with the market. Now there's a lot of competition for the truck. So when the price goes to $4, no one wants to touch the truck. So with Transnet, we have to sign a take or pay, but the trucking contract is more like ad hoc. But the reality is that when you move 1 million tons, you would hope that you have a better alignment of interest with the trucking company. But at the end of the day, it's all about the numbers. So when we were doing the IPO, the delta between the trucking and the railing cost was somewhere around 250 rand per ton. That has now gone up to above 300. In fact, we said that the cost for Transnet was somewhere around 500. The cost for trucking was around 750. Then there were some months where we were paying something close to like 700, but now it has gone above 800. So yeah, so that is why, as I said, that when you have 55% of the cost structure on the rail and the port is in place, the last thing I want is the angst of the local people, the community, and also if you have to have a target that you want to reduce like your cost of production on a substantial basis, then you have to see like how much of the trucks you can take out and how much of that tons you can move to the rail.
It's not a real problem because of the distance between the mine and the actual port.
1,000 kilometers.
Thousands of kilometers away, aren't they?
Yeah, 1,000 kilometers.
Yeah.
About 1,000 kilometers, yeah.
Yeah. So that's the issue. It's not rail, it's affecting the people that...
Yeah, no, I mean, the trucks which are going up and down have been going on for like a long time. So we have all the approvals, and so do the other people, because everyone has to use an element of their production on the trucks. The new guys probably have to use more, because obviously the allegiance of Transnet probably is more to the older companies, so they probably have a lesser portion on the trucks. But we have more portion of the truck, but still our cost is cheaper than some of the, probably most of the players in the Kalahari. So we run like a very, very efficient operation. But every train you have is roughly like 7,000 tons, so that's where the efficiencies come from. I think the truck is hardly like 100 tons, something like that. So if there's more competition, if the price goes to $7, $8, I'm sure like there'll be more competition as the delta will increase.
The market perceives a sovereign risk in investing in South African mines. After reading about laws to expropriate white land and fears about the election, despite President Ramaphosa's efforts to balance the desires of constituents of foreign mining companies in the mining charter, can you please outline to shareholders how the company and partners minimise sovereign risk?
Well, I got a lot of questions along these lines at the time of the IPO, and my honest response was that we put, despite all these perceptions, $100 million, and we got like $300 million back for the shareholders. So I think the talk about the white land and all is not about the land appropriation, I think more on non-mining stuff. But we take the view that we are a very small fish. We've done everything by the book. We're paying like 1.2 billion rand in tax and royalties in the second half. Our marketing entity is set up in South Africa. We pay our share of the 28% tax. So, and then a lot of people say that, oh, you might not be able to take out the money out of South Africa. The reality is we've taken out $300 million equivalent out of South Africa. So my view is that as long as we follow the law of the land and we do everything by the book, we have a good relationship with the DMR and all, it comes together. I mean, no one would have built this mine at like no rail and port allocation. We built it, and all of us are very happy that we took that view and we invested the dollars. So I think the perception, rightly or wrongly, is correct. I mean, those issues are there. But for me, we've got a very good team which manages the situation. We've never had a strike. As I said, we've never had a ship which has been returned because of the grade issue. Never had Section 54 stoppages, which DMR can do anytime unannounced, except for the one which Melissa announced. So, yeah, I beyond that, I really can't give you any assurance. I think no one can. But okay. We've got a new structure, which is 50.1, the law of the land is 26%, so, yeah, we're doing everything by the book and better than what most will expect.
Talking about sovereign risk, we could refer to the inquiry to the Adani situation in Queensland.
Well, I mean, I didn't want to go there, but when we did the listing, someone asked us about the same thing, I think some press guy, and then I was quoted rightly or wrongly by the Western Australian media, where I kind of like really was quite scathing in my attack about our too small iron ore project, because, and I'm talking like 2011, 2010, when the iron ore price was above 100, and we had the money in the bank to build the project, but we never got like all the tick in the boxes from the government, the board, and whoever else we have to share the infrastructure with. So yes, the best country on planet Earth for mining, money in the bank, we could not build the project. It was like very small money, and but at that price, those assets would have made the same sort of money as we make in Chippy. So we lost out, I'm sure the authorities lost out, and then we went to something like South Africa, which people don't have a lot of enthusiasm for, but against the odds, we built it.
Then you were talking about the release in your presentation. Do you have any actual numbers for it?
No. You know what? I put it because the brokers asked me to put it because there are some people who are fascinated about it. But the reality is that it's still, I think, 5 to 10 years away. The only company I know of currently is this company in Germany who's doing some work. But the reality is that the manganese industry is so intrinsically linked with the steel industry that whoever makes manganese doesn't have to justify if it's just using EV and all. I mean, when you talk about lithium and graphite and all, that's the only way you can justify having a credible operation, in my view, because that's where a lot of money has gone and a lot of research has gone. And so
I would just hope we don't really know how much manganese, how many kilograms you expect.
No, whatever we are doing, whatever we are planning, everything is tied to the steel industry. We are not contemplating or doing the work on the expansion because I mean, like, the EV is if that takes up, then maybe we have to build another chicken mine. We have a plant and the infrastructure which can put like 5 million tons. We are producing between 3 to 3.5. So for us to go up to 5 million, obviously we have to see that the market doesn't get crucified and we can get like a better rail and port strategy in place. But to do that is, in my view, like a brownfield expansion. But because we built like a new mine on the cheap 4 or 5 years ago, we learned a lot. So if tomorrow I have to build like another line which is exact replica of, it's like a McDonald's model, like once you can run a McDonald's, you can probably run like 4 or 5 McDonald's. So we can build like 2 or 3 lines.
My but guess is that the world number three was no way to start building a whole line.
No, on the steel market basis and the way I've described supply demand, we can justify an expansion for chip people.
And the large one. About the risk of maybe
think all covered in the prospectus. We have, I think, some sort of an insurance product. So the fact that it's in South Africa doesn't mean that you can cut corners. I mean, it's the history of mining in South Africa is as old as Australia and Canada, so it's very well documented. The systems work, and you have to have a social management program and environment management program, and you have to provide everything to the DMR before they will give you the permit to start construction of the mine. So we have everything in place, and whatever is the provision on which they gave the approval, we have to provide for, and my understanding is that we have some sort of an insurance product in place for that.
You guys are paying a 2.5 cent dividend for the 6 months, and the manganese price, correct me if I'm wrong, averaged about $6 for the period. Now, does one make the assumption that that's what you get for $6, or was it a period where Tshipi retained a little bit of money, or is the first 6 months a period where there's maybe more cash flows? The cash flows are uneven at Tshipi and there.
It is. It's a good question. It is uneven because in the first half, we sold a lot of the low-grade products, which we did in the second half. So you have to take that out. Plus, in the second half, we kept aside like 150 million rand for the two projects I described. So, but if the price remains at $5, I think in the announcement or somewhere, or even in this presentation, we have the leverage. So it will be still, in my view, if price remains $5, a good double-digit lead, but time will tell.
So does that answer imply that you're paying out 100% of your available cash?
Yes. If you look at the balance sheet of Jupiter, it's always had, I think, $14-15 million, which I call rainy money. I mean, like, that money, in fact, is from the days of our iron ore project. So that money is kind of like put in a black box and we really don't touch it. So then whatever Melissa gets as an Australian listed company, again, I made a big deal out of it, but it is the case that we run almost a $1 billion company with like 2 executives and a very small board. So our very lean and mean team, we don't have like too much paraphernalia which goes with this sort of a listing. So we have to take maybe something like $3-4 million every year to run ASX listing, to do our audits and all. So you're absolutely right. Whatever comes from that South African asset, our half share, we take out that much amount, and then whatever the amount left, we will just pay it off.
The other question I have is in relation to capital management. The board has historically said that they're not interested in buybacks.
No, I think that's not the right thing, because what I can say is that the first two payouts which we did in financial year 2017 and 18 were largely through buybacks, because that was the best way to return the capital from a tax perspective. At the time of the IPO, we said that we are positioning Jupiter as a very high dividend paying company. So when we put our neck on the line and say that, then we have to make sure that we kind of promote, whatever we promote should we kind of deliver. So I think for the time being, we would like to stick to that. In my view, it treats like every shareholder fairly. No one can say that you took money from my dividend pocket and gave up to someone who was much more short-term and they sold out. And as I said, although we've got 2 billion shares outstanding, roughly 4 or 5 million shares trade every day. And if Melissa starts to do the buyback, I think that liquidity will become even much more lower. So for the time being, we think that dividend is the best way to return the capital. But that does not mean that buyback is off the table. In fact, every board meeting we have before the payout, we go through the deliberation. Right.
So
we just want to keep it very simple.
So if I give a very quick example, when the share price stayed for months below 25 or at around 25 cents, if it's a constant board item, why did the board not act?
It's too soon
to buy shares.
It's too soon. We are not going to do things like on the go. We said for the first year this is going to be a high yield paying company, high dividend yield, and we basically stuck to it. If the price remains at 25 cents for the next few years, then maybe we will look at that. But for the time being, we really wanted to say that this is what we promised the market, and we want to substantiate that with the delivery. I mean, the board looks at the share price, but does it give us sleepless nights that the share price is 20-25 cents? No. I mean, our chairman is not here. He will give you the example of Village in that. He listed the company and then the financial crisis happened and he had enough money in the bank to take the company private and no bank would give him the money against that. And then I think the audience know better than I that what happened to that company and what that morphed into. And I was personally involved with a company called Vedanta and the same thing happened on the LSE. You have to... Everyone makes big promises. You have to give the market some comfort back by the numbers that what you're promising is happening. And then we would hope that it reflects in the share price, which I don't know today, it's whatever, 30 cents, 31 cents. But with time, I think it will correct.
So at the IPO price, would you... and the way the market is now, would you consider that IPO price to be a bargain?
A bargain? I mean, that you have to, I mean, I took shares at the IPO price, I've taken shares at 70 cents, so I'm not the right person to ask whether to buy that is the right price or 40 cents is the right price. So, I mean, the way I've sketched out to you, I think one thing is very clear is that if someone has patience and they are willing to hold on to the stock, good money has to be made. But if someone is going to look at the screen every day and get in and get out, highly unlikely they will be happy with owning the stock. So it's a very simple thing that if you have a little bit of a longer term view and you want the dividend, this is a stock. If you're thinking of buybacks, trade in, trade out, then this is not moving for you.
I don't understand why the liquidity is so low to me. I just don't understand that.
I think the liquidity is low because, I mean, I can sell my shares, but where do I invest the money? That's I think, a big challenge for a lot of people, especially the ones who are a little bit long-term, that if I'm not interested in selling the shares, for me, whether the price is 25 cents or 45 cents, does not matter. Maybe it makes me a little bit happy when I see 45 on the screen. But I am, and I think a lot of our big investors are there because of the promise we made, which is like, this is going to be a high-yield paying company. This is not like...
And that's you, for a number of years, you think that's going on.
These are the three things. If I can't lose, cross, yeah. And honestly, to do some of these things, I'm sure the shareholders will support if I have to ask them for some money, but anything we do, we will come back to the shareholders. And the company belongs to the shareholders, they can decide what they want to do. Keep it very simple. It's just two people, we have to pick and choose our battles. And two out of the five board members are here. So, this is it. If you go to Perth, you probably have a hard time finding Melissa's office. We don't need it. The money is made in South Africa. We have very good people there. But that does not mean we waste our money because the cost of production literally shows you everything. I mean, that cost of production is the all-in cost of production, if I can say, because there's no debt, there's nothing to be serviced. There's no, like, hundreds of people running around. So thank you, Anshita.
Just for going forward, obviously another 3 years here.
Yeah, we've got until 2023, yes.
With the tension to be more strained there, or are you confident you can roll that agreement?
I would hope that once we have delivered our side of the bargain, filling the boats, filling the trains whenever they come, and helping them out if other people screw up and we try and take that capacity, I think we will get like a fair treatment. Can I say that it'll be 2.1 for the next 15, 20 years, I think. At least. We started the thing without anything in our pocket. Now we've got a 5-year contract and I think slowly we're building up the credibility in the trading market, with Transnet, with everyone. I'm sure in 4 or 5 years' time, like I said, all our product is universally acknowledged as one of the best. In a few years' time, I think the shareholders will also say that, yeah, they had a very simple message and they more or less delivered it. Thank you.
Claire, can we...
Sorry, I forgot.
Hi, Claire. Is there anything?
Hi. Sure, okay. Thank you, Priyank. Thanks, Melissa. So, guests are invited to ask questions.
I hope the questions are not the same as what I've answered.
I'm sure not. The guests are asked to ask questions by pressing *1 on your telephone keypad now. You'll be placed in a queue. Please listen to your name and I'll introduce you through. Thank you. Okay, at this stage, we do have a question from Anista, a shareholder. I'll just join you through. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Hi, Priyank. The name's Anesita Mijoglu, and I've been involved in stockbroking and corporate activities for many years. I noticed that, and I'm a relatively large shareholder. And my question is, I noticed that in all of our presentations, and I'm very happy with your presentation, but I noticed in all of the presentations, there tends to be this overemphasis on what a wonderful dividend yield the company's paying. And yes, I am happy with the dividend yield, but as we all know, dividend yield is a function of share price. So if next year the share price is trading at 15 cents, we'll be on a 50% dividend. So the question that I'm asking is, why would people be selling the shares to bring our share price down to 30 cents? Because we cannot say that this fantastic dividend yield has only got to do with the operations. It's got to do with the fact that people have been selling down their holdings.
Well, as far as I can judge, there's not much selling. I think I said time and again that the volume of trade, which I see every day, is like a few million shares. Maybe you should ask your clients to buy more.
Well, there's,
but
the money runs
down. The share price, I really can't say much because it is not in my control. If you as a shareholder feel that we have said something and we have not delivered, then I'm more than happy to engage on that. But I really can't engage on, like, why is the share price 30 cents or 15 cents or 45 cents. I mean,
okay, but the,
honestly,
yeah, but
that's
the company,
not in my control.
Yes, I understand that. But one shouldn't only take Apple for the high dividend yield when it's got to do with a drop in the share price.
Well, I think Melissa in her report also said that what the dividend yield would be at the IPO price, which was, I think, 18 or 19%, which I think is pretty compelling.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. At this stage, Priyank, we have no further questions.
Thank you so much.
Thanks
everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.